So, we're warming up. Why don't we do some five questions here?
Okay.
Would you like to go for a run around the track?
Yes, definitely.
Would you like some sunflower seeds?
As many as you've got.
Would you like to break into an Air Force base?
Oh, absolutely.
Would you like to stick your hand in a nest of bile?
You know what? I might pass on that one, actually.
Would you like to watch some porn?
This is the part where I plead the Fifth Amendment, I think, isn't it?
Do you have the Fifth Amendment?
We don't, but we need it desperately.
Okay. Oh, wow. Podcast. Okay. Welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Paige Schechter, and today's show will be on the man, the myth, Fox William Mulder from season one. I'm joined by the ever extraordinary L.W. Yinkers.
I feel really bad that I haven't looked up any anagrams of your name there, Paige.
Well, you might know him better by the name he uses on social media, Carl Sweeney.
That's my pseudonym, yes, that's right. Hi, Paige, how's it going?
Hi, Carl. It's going very well. Are you ready to take this journey into the mind and manners of Mulder?
I really am, you know, because it's like, you know, as we're recording, it's Saturday night, you know, I've got a drink open, we're about to talk X-Files. I almost literally couldn't be any happier right now.
Excellent.
So, yes, let's do it.
Okay. Well, before we even ever saw him, we heard him described with the nickname Spooky. And he went to Oxford. He was the best analyst in the violent crime section, and he was interested in unexplained phenomenon. And then we were introduced to him with the legendary line, "Sorry, nobody down here but the FBI's most unwanted." So while the FBI may not have wanted him, the exact opposite was true of the X-Files viewers. We sympathized with his struggles to bring the truth to light. We agonized with his pain over the bizarre disappearance of his sister. And we laughed at his ability to coin a phrase and reference pop culture. So, Carl, think way, way back and try to remember what you first thought of Fox Mulder.
Well, I don't know. I think I always found Mulder very appealing, you know, and that's the thing with season one Mulder, I think, is that David Duchovny, he's had his most, like, fresh face to that point, isn't he? And I think a large part of that appeal is down to that as well. And I don't know, I sort of, when I think back to season one, I sort of feel like Duchovny was kind of playing himself into the role, you know, over the course of the first year. But I don't really think that's a problem at all. It's not a criticism, you know, because I think lots of iconic characters don't always emerge, like, fully formed. It's always fun to go back and look at those season one episodes and see him sort of trying to, you know, hone his characterization of Mulder, I think. At least that's how I see it. What do you reckon?
Well, I thought we kind of knew a lot about who he was from the get-go, and that was really different from the show's other main character, Dana Scully. And I think Chris Carter sort of had a pretty good vision of who Fox Mulder was, and he came out of the box tailor-made for being liked with his obvious wit and intelligence.
Yeah, I guess what I'm thinking of is I think that if you think back to like the pilot, for example, you know, I think that the Mulder you see there is a bit more kind of zany as he's played than he would go on to be, you know. And I think Duchovny probably like, he probably downplayed that to some extent, you know, a lot more than other actors would have. But I think he continues to kind of, he sort of grows into that sort of deadpan role phenomenally well, I think, you know.
Right.
Whereas I think the pilot Mulder's quite a curious kind of portrayal, actually. And it's a lot of fun to go back and look at it and just see that, you know, he kind of tones down some aspects of his character, you know, as he goes along.
Well, we know he's a phenomenal profiler and we really see his intelligence level. I think that sort of lifts him far above a guy who just wants to believe in these things. You know, it gives him some credibility.
Yeah, and he's got this, you're right, because he sort of brings this kind of intellectual heft to the character, doesn't he?
Right.
You know, and if that wasn't there, like you say, it would not only destroy kind of his credibility, but the series, potentially, you know. But no, you never get that sense, do you? So yeah, that's a good point, I think.
Right, but while the viewers may have taken to him rather quickly, I don't think the same would be said about the previous people he'd work with or the people he runs into, officials and whatnot, because he's got a bit of a reputation.
Well, that's what I love about Season 1 Mulder, actually. And I'm curious to see what you think as well, because you really do get the sense, don't you, that he's this kind of outsider, you know, he's kind of a maverick figure within the FBI. I mean, to be blunt, he's a joke at the FBI, isn't he? You know,
he is, and, yes.
You really see that in episodes like The Pilot and Squeeze, and even stuff like Lazarus, I think. I don't know, do you sort of feel the same way I do, that sort of disappears a bit as the series goes on, and that it's a bit of a shame?
Yeah, it sort of does. And then, you know, when we get to Fallen Angel and he finds out that people have been following him and he's not just this lone figure, that people understand what his quest is, maybe that sort of turns the tide a little.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of him being this kind of joke, like you mentioned already, like Spooky Mulder, and I always think it's a shame, you know, that they drop that nickname to some extent, because you hear a lot of that in Season 1 and Season 2, and then it's pretty rare afterwards. It always seemed like Morgan and Wong were particularly fond of making sure he was referred to as Spooky in their episodes.
But, right.
Yeah, I just love it whenever the Spooky thing comes up, and anything that kind of highlights how much of a, you know, this weird kind of figure in the FBI is good in my book.
You can say it. You can say the word. He's an arse.
He's an arse, isn't he? He truly is. I mean, imagine working alongside this guy, you know.
Not only does he not show respect for the other people he works with, he's really not too keen on accepting anybody else's explanation on things. You know, what he sees is what it is. And of course, because it's the X-Files, it probably is what he sees. But he doesn't win any points for that with the people he works with.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think in Season 1, one thing I like about Eve, the episode Eve, is like, in that episode, doesn't his theory, like his initial theory, turn out to be wrong? And he sort of has to kind of rethink it on the fly. I like that. So I like it whenever it's not quite so straightforward, you know.
Yeah, he's got the red lightning and the exsanguination.
That's it, yeah.
Theory.
But in terms of, like you're saying, with the people they work with, I'll tell you one thing that's always kind of funny. If you go back and look at those first, I don't know, like half a dozen episodes of Season 1, is that, do you remember there's like this set they go to? It's like a communal office or something in the FBI. It's in a few of the early episodes, like Jersey Devil. And it's there in the first run of episodes from time to time, and then it disappears, and you just really see them in the basement after that. So it's kind of clear they hadn't fully figured out that the best way to, like, show Mulder and Scully within the FBI all the time was in that basement office, kind of secluded. You sort of see them develop all these things as the year goes on, don't you? So it's a really, I think it's a really effective kind of learning, you know, kind of test ground that first year.
Well, one of the things we find out is he doesn't just want to, you know, like a lot of people who are interested in the paranormal, they want to be abducted by aliens, to coin a phrase from later on in the run. But he doesn't just want that. He wants to find the proof behind it, and he wants to be able to convince other people with this proof. The trouble is that in the first season, by and large, all this stuff happens and Scully's not around to see it.
And also, like, what I really like about, like, Deep Throat, the episode Deep Throat as well, is that, like, he sees all sorts of stuff in Deep Throat, but then his memory gets wiped as well. So I always thought that was quite clever, you know, that you get to episode 2 and that you have this kind of reset of sorts so that, like, the audience knows a bit more than the characters do at that point. But, yeah, the thing about Scully always being like two steps behind, you know, that is very much what I think of when I think back to some of these early episodes. And it did become a bit of a running joke, didn't it? And, you know, I guess it was kind of unavoidable, wasn't it? They had to keep churning these episodes out, didn't they?
Right, right. That reminds me of another thing that always happens because, you know, they're tied to this formula.
Yeah.
He never really dismisses the obvious answers before he jumps to the conclusions. And it would be nice for him to address, like, some obvious possibilities, like about things like lights in the night sky with a line of dialogue before jumping right into planes built with UFO technology.
I mean, that's definitely true, but also I do like it. There are times when, like, you know, they're investigating the crime scene or whatever, and like Scully will say, "Well, you know, what do you think this represents?" And you know, there are loads of times where he's like, "Oh, well, I don't know yet." I do like that he's not quite. He's in, you know, like we say, he's incredibly intelligent. He's incredibly like intuitive, but there are these gaps in his knowledge, and he's not this kind of master detective figure who, you know, can immediately jump to everything, even if he is, you know, very often correct with his kind of main hypothesis, you know.
Right. So that's a fair point, that, you know, he takes all this in and then he comes with the outlandish theory.
Yeah, because I just remember, I think it might have been Glenn Morgan talking about this in interviews, but it was like one of Chris Carter's early notes on the character of Mulder was that Mulder doesn't take notes, you know. So I don't know, it feels to me, looking back at those old episodes, like, you know, Scully's the one walking around with a notepad, and Mulder sort of, like you say, takes it all in. We know he's got this kind of photographic memory that comes and goes as the series demands it as well, you know, which is quite funny.
Sort of like his fear of fire.
Stuff like that, fear of fire, colour blindness, you know. It's very early 90s TV in that respect, isn't it, I think?
It is. Well, we're talking about some of the defining characteristics, and maybe we should get a bit into some of the submissions we got online.
Yeah, so I put the call out, you know, to get people's thoughts on the character of Mulder in Season 1. And I thought we had some, like, really good comments come back. So the first one was from Kathy, who said, where do I begin? I love that he can sense who to trust. He trusts Scully and Deep Throat more than most people would find reasonable, but he was right. He's very perceptive, intuitive. It shows why he was a great profiler without explicitly saying that. A standout moment for me is the way he helps Max in Fallen Angel, showing his compassion for the outsider, the hurt and the neglected. He's often characterized as so wrapped up in himself and his quest that he doesn't think about anyone else, but this scene belies that. So, I mean, what do you think, Paige? Because I think that's a good point, because I sometimes think of Mulder as being, like, wrapped up in himself. And I think there are times when he definitely is. But, like, Kathy makes a good point too, doesn't she? That, you know, he does have this immense compassion for kind of, like, marginal figures too, doesn't he? Like Max, or, like, the people in Conduit as well, for example.
Yes, yes, I agree about that. The figure in Jersey Devil and the homeless man in Jersey Devil. These are the people that he has more of an affinity for. He likes tough-talking women who've gotten a wrong deal. I mean, that's a character trait that will stick with him through the years. But especially, particularly with Max, that relationship, as brief as it was for that one episode in this time period we're talking about,
yeah,
you see that, you feel the bond there. He loves the other intrepid souls in search of a close encounter.
I mean, I'm guessing that must be an aspect of his character that you're kind of into, because I know, like, one of your favorite episodes is Mind's Eye, isn't it? Season 5, and, like,
it is.
That'd be a great example of what Kathy's talking about, wouldn't it?
It would, and Oubliette, and there are many where it goes beyond, you know, he's seen as this self-involved guy who's obsessed with his sister's disappearance, and we get many examples of it being a lot more than that.
Yes, we do. And let me see who else tweeted us. And Christian said, Season 1 Mulder is classic Mulder. It's the way I always see him. His obsessiveness into the unknown, his devotion to finding his sister, and his pervasive paranoia into the conspiracy. I think the Deep Throat episode perfectly encapsulates some of these traits. So yeah, I definitely agree. Obsessiveness, devotion, and paranoia, that sums him up pretty well, I think.
Definitely. And we were talking about this a little, and it's a bit of a rocky road when you want to talk about it, but in Roland, he very much empathizes with Roland. The writer of that episode, Chris Ruppenthal, I'm wondering if he sort of drew some kind of parallel, if he sort of saw Mulder as being somewhere on the autistic spectrum. Obviously not autistic the way Roland is, but just skirting the outside of it in terms of his obsessiveness. It feels like he was drawing some kind of parallel there.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, you're definitely right. He is particularly, like genuine and empathetic with Roland, isn't he? It's actually quite touching from what I remember.
It is.
Yeah, even though that's an episode that, you know, that's quite easy to overlook episodes like Roland, I think. Because it seems to me, I don't know if you agree, but like the back end of season one, I don't know, maybe the hit and miss ratio kind of drops off a bit and you get stuff like Born Again and Roland, which they're fine, but they're not kind of great, are they? You sort of feel a bit like it had been a long year and they're kind of waiting for the end of the season, you know?
Well, I just came off the Underrated podcast, and the two you just mentioned were both in it, and we have a lot of arguments in favor of it. I think they're a lot more solid than people give them credit for, but maybe it just is because it's the end of the year, and you're kind of waiting for what the Erlenmeyer flask is going to be, and of course, Tombs, you know, the return of Tombs, and these things are such, you know, landmark presences in season one that Born Again and Roland get a little bit pushed aside, maybe, and don't deserve to be.
Perhaps. I suppose it is hard to follow up, like, Darkness Falls and Tombs, isn't it? So, maybe.
Exactly.
Okay, so Michelle Milbauer said, "I love smart-ass Mulder. All of his quips, one-liners, and just general messing with people are the best. Mulder asking Tombs about his missing Norwegian elk hound. We call him Heinrich." Makes me laugh every time. So yeah, definitely. I mean, we'll probably come on to talk a bit more about the humor and stuff, won't we? But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, we can get into that now and then come back. I always thought that one of the reasons the show did take off the way it did extended far beyond, you know, the conspiracy or aliens or Samantha's abduction. The humor played a pretty big part, and in the first season, it comes largely from Mulder.
Yes, definitely. And I think it definitely is a huge part of the series, like, appeal. Because like, I don't think it's any... Even though I love Season 8, I think when you get to Season 8 and Mulder's gone and you have this, you know, this interesting relationship between Doggett and Scully, but the aspect that's missing is the banter, isn't there? There are some one-liners, but the kind of the witty repartee is gone. Like you say, yeah, when I think back to Season 1, it is mostly Mulder cracking wise that I think of. I suppose Scully kind of comes into her own a bit more as the series goes on, I guess.
Well, she does it some in season one, but they're all sort of awkward. They're not...
Are you thinking of any in particular?
The Jersey Devil one, Defying Gravity.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I never really... It's never really a laugh-out-loud one. Like, the first truly dazzling piece of business we referenced earlier, is there any way I can get it off my hands quickly without betraying my cool exterior? It's so Mulder. It's so unique. You know, it's not like every other kind of one-liner.
Yeah, definitely. And I love as well when he kind of busts out that humor in situations like with the other agents in Squeeze, you know, and he starts going off about reticulans and stuff like that. You know?
Right, yep.
Absolutely, like, playing up to his reputation within the Bureau and stuff like that. I think, like, Duchovny was always good at that, and he was, you know, continued to be good at that kind of thing in season 11, didn't he? Because, like, when he turns up on the scene in, like, I think it's Nothing Lasts Forever, and there are these, like, young agents now, and he's still pulling, like, the same kind of tricks with his colleagues, isn't he?
He is.
Okay, so just got a couple more on this subject, I think. So, Priyangana Lahar said, "You know, season one, according to me, was mostly about character development and story furthering, less about the actors themselves or their chemistry. I was certainly drawn to the agent's stubborn belief, but felt a tad frustrated at times. Quite a swift thinker when it came to fast movement. That's all I can think about season one Mulder." So I think that's an interesting point, but I'm not sure if I agree, because I think it is about the actors to a large degree, season one for me, because I think you can really see, like, Gillian Anderson growing in confidence as Scully, you know, up to the point where, like, you get something like Beyond the Sea in the middle of the season where she, like, just knocks it out of the park. And I also feel like Duchovny grows in stature throughout the year too. So for me, that is part of the enjoyment of going back to watch year one, you know, is seeing those two kind of start to personify these characters. But what do you reckon?
I sort of agree with you, but I understand that point that was made as well. I think Ice, of course, was the first truly brilliant episode, and that's where we really see what everything is going to become. The performances in that are great. For David, I thought Young at Heart is sort of an underrated episode in terms of his acting. That's the one in which they go back to Reggie Perdue and his very first case, and he didn't take this kill shot when he had it because it wasn't by the book, and a fellow agent and a driver died. It's one of the highlights of the season for me as far as David's acting. Even though we know how this episode's going to play out, this time he's going to be able to take his shot. But the way they get there is really brilliant.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that, like you say, we know what's going to basically happen. So it's a bit kind of rote, I guess, in that respect. But yeah, especially the first half of that episode, I think, is quite effective. And yeah, I guess that would be one of the highlights for him. I'm just trying to think. I mean, for me, one of the highlights in terms of his acting would be Toombs, I think. I think he's brilliant there. Especially that hearing or whatever it is, the courtroom type scene where he's kind of giving the background to Toombs, and he must just sound absolutely demented, to any to those people. But I think the episode gives him a good range, because it's that stuff, but there's also like this kind of where he's shadowing Toombs and things like that, and when he's on his stakeout and he's tired and he has the scene in the car with Scully. So I guess that would be one of my highlights in terms of him.
That's a good one.
And then lastly, we just heard from Marlene. She said that previously I focused on how Duchovny and Anderson settled into character in season one. Now I tend to see all the threads of their characters in nascent form. Mulder's empathy for Scully is a strong attribute, as is his empathy for people down on their luck. I think of the scene with Max Fennig in Fallen Angel when Max has a seizure, has a seizure in his trailer. Mulder showed compassion unusual for a male character of that time. And I think that is a good point, actually, that lots of the traits and things are there, even if they become more prominent in the future, aren't they?
Right.
So it is fascinating to see them emerge. Also, you see some things drop away though, don't you? Because like I tell you, the scene that sticks out like a sore thumb to me is in the pilot. The scene on the airplane when they're on the way to Oregon and Mulder's kind of spread out on the seats and everything. And then they run through the turbulence, and he's just kind of unnaturally calm. I don't think you ever see that kind of moment from him again, do you? That always seems a bit out of place to me.
I understand what you mean. That's a little bit like, he's not too jostled here by something that's just a basic, is he expecting aliens to come and save him if the craft actually starts to go down, or I don't know.
I mean, we don't see that many flights over the course of the series, do we? So maybe he is flying like that all the time. But I think that's what I meant at the outset when I said, that the Mulder in the pilot always seems a little, not off to me, but, kind of different to how he is afterwards. Actually, I did have one more tweet I can read out,
Okay.
Paige, and it's from Michael John Petty, who said, "Mulder's willingness to trust those who might lead him to the truth was always an admirable and often damaging quality that really started with Deep Throat. He trusted Scully too, but I think part of that was subconsciously to balance his own obsession." Yeah, I think that's a good point to touch on though, isn't it? Because like this thing about him being willing to trust people, it's definitely true, isn't it? Even though that when you think about the X-Files, trust no one are some of the first words that come to mind. And they even play on it a bit in, I think it's Colony, isn't it? When Mulder says in season two, Mulder's like, "I changed it to trust everyone." But
Right.
yeah, he definitely is like, at times he does take these leaps to believe in people. It's quite endearing.
Right. Well, trust no one, of course, coming from Max in Fallen Angel. One of the other ones where you're like, why is he trusting this person is in Darkness Falls when he trusts the eco-terrorist with their only transportation in or out of the forest and without discussion with Scully, which at that point is a little strange since they're a pretty solid team at the end of season one. But he's also wonderful with her later in that episode where she's freaking out because the mites are everywhere, and he really talks her down off of that one.
Yeah, I think that earlier section you mentioned, though, that is really striking, actually, when he does make the decision without her. I mean, I think the last time I watched that episode, I was just like, what are you doing, Mulder? Because that really could have. They were really fortunate in that instance, weren't they? They get this weird kind of rescue at the end. But yeah, I mean, the bond with Scully is a fascinating kind of topic of discussion, too, isn't it, for season one?
Yeah, we should get into some Bond with Scully talk.
I don't know about you, Paige, but I think it's definitely a platonic bond that they establish. I'll say that word again, platonic. What do you think?
I agree with you. The denizens of the Dana Scully Season 1 podcast probably would not. It's a growing mutual respect. It starts in a pretty strong place because not as far as the bond. I mean, just the relationship. Because he thinks she was sent to spy on him. She's part of the government agenda. But he still wants to either change her mind or open it a little. You know, he explains the laws of physics don't seem to apply in most of his cases. And so when conventional science can't provide the answers, they have to turn to the fantastic.
How much of a heads up do you think he got that Scully was coming down to the basement? Because he's clearly had the time to locate and read her thesis, hasn't he?
That's true.
In addition to setting up the slideshow, you know, booking the plane tickets and all that. So, you know, he's done his homework before Scully turns up. You know, you get the sense that he wanted to impress her, I think, even though he kind of adopts this kind of weird, like, slightly antagonistic stance. But yeah, no, they immediately do establish, like, this kind of intellectual back and forth between the two of them that serves the series so well, doesn't it? But I think when I said platonic, though, let me explain that a bit, because what I meant was platonic in the truest sense, really. And I think when I say it, what I mean is, like, they're intimate, you know, they're affectionate, but I don't see any kind of sexual aspect to Mulder and Scully in Season 1. And I know for a fact that people listening will be, you know, in complete disagreement with me.
Right.
But I just don't see it.
No, there's the moment in Ice where he turns around so she can examine his back and neck for a big worm that would be inching its way through him.
Well, yeah, it's physical intimacy.
Right.
But it's, in my view, it's not yet, like, romantic or sexual is the difference, I think.
And, of course, in the pilot, when he's checking out by candlelight her bug bites, yeah. You know, it definitely makes the temperature go up, but I don't see of it anything beyond that.
No, I don't either. And I mean, there are also some other good moments in terms of, like, you know, like tactile moments, aren't there? Like when he holds her face after her father's died in Beyond the Sea is a good one. Or even moments like when he fingers, for want of a better word, the necklace in Squeeze. Do you remember that moment when he kind of stops her by putting his finger around her necklace? That's a good moment too.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, I mean, physical and affectionate. Intimate, yes, yes, yes. I don't know about anything beyond that, though, at this stage. But it's often expressed through dialogue, too, isn't it? You know, it's not just touching and looks. There's some great dialogue between the two of them as well.
I think you kind of see, back to Beyond the Sea for a second, that when he's first talking to her about her father's death, it's so awkward. It's like the most awkward conversation you've ever seen on television. Just like, oh, Dana. It just, you know, there's no intimacy there yet. You know, it's a building relationship, and that's what I love about it. You know, I've never been considered a shipper. Obviously, who else could be right for these two people in the long run? But I don't need to see them get it on.
I guess not. I mean, in terms of that moment you said with him calling her Dana, there's like a nice flip side to that, I think, isn't there, in Tombs, which is when they're on the stakeout and she calls him Fox, you know, and he kind of laughs it off, you know, and like he's like, I always made my parents call me Mulder. That conversation in Tombs, the iced tea conversation, it seems to me like a particularly good example of their Season 1 bond, you know, because it's a serious conversation, it's a close, you know, emotionally close conversation at times, but it's laced with humour as well. So that little scene is a perfect kind of capsule of their Season 1 growing relationship, I think.
Speaking of bonds, now we haven't really gone too much into the Samantha story, which is, of course, a big, big one of the driving forces of the show. In the pilot, he talks about how he's undergone hypnosis and tried to access his repressed memories, and he remembers a bright light and being so paralyzed with fear he couldn't help his sister, and he believes the government knows all about it. And we really find out how bad it is how haunting it is for him in Conduit. He feels like he's walking into that room every day and just hoping Samantha will be there. And so his sadness and his guilt are fueling a lot of his quest. Do you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. And for me, like watching the series in the early years, that was always very like a very powerful thing, you know. And I mean, in terms of season one, I mean, what I find interesting is like the version of the Samantha like backstory we get is quite a like provisional one, in the sense that some of the details we get in the pilot and in Conduit are different, aren't they, to what we then learn in like Little Green Men and beyond. So like, I think in the pilot they talk about Samantha was taken from her bed and stuff like that.
Right.
And that isn't the case when we finally see the flashback in Little Green Men, you know, and that sort of seems to be the version that sticks, isn't it, with the board game and everything.
Right.
Also, you know, do you remember the young actress we see playing Samantha in Miracle Man late in season one?
Mm-hmm.
So we get that little subplot, don't we? And we never see that young girl again. And I think, like, when I think of Samantha Mulder in my head, it's the actress from Little Green Men is the one, really, you know, who I think of. So all that's interesting, but nevertheless, I think the abduction stuff we do get works pretty well, you know, because I think Duchovny's pretty good at that stuff. And the Samantha scene in the pilot and the stuff about her in Conduit, I find very effective, yeah.
You know what's interesting is that all these things he does believe in, but there are times where he absolutely won't believe, and it's usually something about religion or faith. There, in Beyond the Sea, he's not believing the bond there between Boggs and Scully. He's much more willing to believe in aliens there.
Yeah, I think Beyond the Sea is a very valuable episode, actually, because, I mean, I guess we think of it mainly as a Scully-like vehicle, and it is. But it's very worthwhile, I think, to have times when Mulder doesn't really buy the overriding explanation, you know, whatever it might be. And it's actually quite a nice little wrinkle to his character, I think, that he gets this obstinate. I don't know if you agree or not.
Oh, I do. I do agree. You know what is interesting also in Miracle Man, the guy who seems to believe absolutely everything says people want miracles so bad that they see what they want to see. And he includes himself in that mix. He knows that about himself when it comes to Samantha.
Yeah, and obviously that's quite tragic when you think that, like, years down the line, he'll discover that she was dead all along and everything. And we get that very, I think it's very powerful anyway, the stuff in Closure, where he's actually at peace with it, finally.
Yes. Know?
But yeah, definitely. I'll tell you one thing that's a bit odd in that respect, then, in terms of season one, is that we get the scene in Conduit, I think it's the last scene, or it's at the end anyway, where he's in the church, you know, and given all we've said that, you know, he sort of decries organized religion at times and stuff like that, it seems kind of weird that he would go and sit in the church at that point,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
It does.
In light of his attitudes later in the series, it seems a bit of a false note. But even so, I think there's something very nice about that little scene. But I don't think they would have written it that way a year or two later. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes. I definitely agree on that.
Yeah.
But it's nice to, like you said, it's nice to have that where it is. And in the overall picture, that makes sense. It's just a nice little moment. Okay, some other things from season one that we don't really see too much later. The first season, there's a lot of our agents' backstories and who they worked with and who they had romances with. And we've mentioned a couple of those so far. But there's also in Ghost in the Machine, his partner from Behavioral Analysis Unit. Jerry LaManna asked him to aid the murder investigation. And it's sort of interesting that they largely, we have Diana Fowley waiting in the wings to depress us all. But in the first season, it's very heavy on that, on both sides, you know, for both characters. And then it kind of goes away.
Yeah, I kind of like that it goes away in the sense that if you think about it from Scully's point of view, for example, she had a relatively commonplace social life, it seems, and everything. Like, she goes to her friend's cello recitals and she goes to her godson's birthday party and all that stuff. So I do like the sense you get that all that drops away, the sort of deeper involved with Mulder and the X-Files she gets, you know. I mean, as for Mulder, I don't know if I find all that backstory stuff quite as interesting. I mean, I do like the sense of naivety you get, though. Like with Jerry, like you mentioned, that, what is it? He turns up and he steals Mulder's profile or something, isn't it?
Right.
Is that right? So, and I like the sense that Mulder's kind of just been done over, basically, by his old mate. And I think there are a few examples of Mulder being quite naive in this first season. So it's not really a backstory thing, but when he meets the astronaut guy, Marcus Aurelius Belt, yeah, that's that moment when he's kind of crestfallen, when he sees him lie to the press. You know, you sort of see this boyish side to Mulder in some of these early episodes that I quite like. And side note, I've got a weird soft spot for the kind of puppyish Mulder we see in space.
But even though that happened, he still does hold him in high regard. I guess he's a little bit used to being disappointed by his heroes.
Well, there's a saying, isn't there, about never meet, was it, about having your idol, meeting
never
your
meet,
idols.
And never meet your idols.
Yeah. Something like that. And like people having feet made of clay or whatever it is. And you very much get that sense, don't you? But yeah, what about some of these other figures then? Because Jerry's the first one, isn't he? And then who comes afterwards from Mulder's past?
Well, there's Phoebe, the game-playing ex-paramour, and Reggie Perdue.
All right, what about Phoebe then? Because do you buy that Mulder would have been into her in his days at Oxford?
Oh, God. Well, you know what? I think he would have found appealing in her is... She has this intelligence, and she knows how to get to him. She knows how to make him play her game. And so, for a while, I could see him being into that.
You know, they talk about their frolic on the Arthur Conan Doyle's tombstone and stuff. So, kind of a dangerous side to her, kind of an exciting side to her, I guess, as well.
Yeah, that goes well with the porn thing, I think.
Yeah. Well, she's like introduced with, what is it? She tries to make them think the car's about to explode or something, isn't it?
Right.
From the tape.
Now, I think any time that you have a tape in your car, you probably want to exit the vehicle. An unknown tape in your car.
And what do you think about like Scully, though? Because like she's reacts to Phoebe in quite an interesting way, doesn't she?
I never really read too much into that. I mean, it's just, you know, oh, this is somebody Mulder knew, and let's see how they interact, because she's a scientist, she's studying it a little. I don't particularly see her as jealous or anything like that.
I think she definitely seemed to think that Phoebe was quite a dislikable piece of work. Yeah, whether it was jealousy as such, I'm not sure I see it in quite that light either. But yeah, so Phoebe Green, I mean... Thank goodness we never saw her again, you know.
Oh, yes. Amen.
I mean, Reggie was a nice guy, I thought. I quite like Reggie. Out of this little run of characters, Reggie was a good one.
Reggie.
When he gets bumped off, that was quite sad.
Wait a minute. Do you even understand the Reggie thing? Do you understand that?
I certainly
that?
Do. I get it. Don't worry. Okay. I'm hip.
I'm not sure if it crossed the Atlantic or not, but... You know, over here where we're eating Reggie bars, we understand it really well.
Oh, I don't know then. What Reggie bars? What's that, like a chocolate?
Yeah, Reggie is a chant for Yankees slugger Reggie Jackson, and he had Reggie bars and candy with nuts shaped like it was round like a baseball, and at the games people would chant Reggie, Reggie, which is why Mulder chants Reggie, Reggie.
Oh, right. No, I didn't know that. No. I mean, if I've learned anything today, there we are. It's that.
Insight. Unique insight.
I never would have... I just assumed it was some kind of private joke between the two of them, you know. So that's fascinating. I'll tell you someone who Mulder seems to know from the past, who's quite an under-discussed figure, you know. I can't remember her name. There's like a handwriting expert he goes to see in Young at Heart. Do you remember her?
Oh, yeah.
And she's quite, like, flirtatious and
yes.
stuff. She seems quite playful. I wish we'd have seen a bit more of her, you know. She seemed like a promising character.
That would have been great. I would have liked to have seen more of her. You're right, though. No one ever mentions that. No one ever brings that up.
Yeah. I mean, the Lone Gunman, I guess, well, we're going to talk about them.
Yep.
Because I think that it's good that we see people like Max and the Lone Gunman who seem a bit more kind of authentic. In terms of, like, when I think about, like, conspiracy hunters, you know, I don't think of people who look as kind of Hollywood as Mulder and Duchovny do. But those guys really do seem to fit those parts well, I think.
I agree. I when I first saw them, I called them the three other Max Fennigs.
Definitely. I mean, it just stops Mulder seeming a bit too glamorous, I think, in a weird sort of way, because they interact so well with each other. He seems to sort of be grounded by them, and I quite like that.
Well, a good aspect of it is because that we meet them in EBE, and this is when his regard for Deep Throat is slipping, because Deep Throat is sending them on wild goose chases.
Yeah.
And now there are people who Mulder really can trust, these three fun, crazy, wacky guys who think that Mulder's theories are more outlandish than theirs, and they have some pretty outlandish ones. But it's good. It's a good point to have them come in and be more people that Mulder can count on and that we can root for.
Yeah, and also they have this kind of dangerous edge to them at the beginning. You know, stuff like them ripping up the $20 note and stuff like that seems to work better to me, at least. I know they're very popular, you know, amongst the fans and everything, but when you get to the stage where they're like ice skating and, you know, doing all these weird kind of Mission Impossible type spying ventures, they just don't appeal to me as much, you know. But I really like the way they're sort of introduced in EBE. That's it, isn't it? I can't think of any other characters we meet in terms of backstory figures.
Except for, of course, Deep Throat, who has been, you know. Oh, and there is reference to him, to Mulder having sources in Congress.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really find that interesting, actually, because it's only obliquely mentioned, isn't it? It's mentioned in the pilot.
Right.
And then when is it next mentioned? I can only remember them talking a bit about it in Tombs when Skinner says, like, next time all your friends on the Hill won't count for nothing or whatever he says. But that's about it, isn't it?
Yeah, in the first season. And it does come into play later. It's sort of good to have those touch points that can be reflected on later. Not, you know, not everything needed to be in season one. And I sort of like that, you know, there would be people in Congress who are not, you know, who don't want to go the way everybody else is going and might be interested in what Mulder's theories are.
Yeah, I almost wish they'd have done a bit more there, either with, like, Matheson or with some other characters, because it sort of seemed like quite a rich seam they could have tapped into.
And they never did. I mean, even...
Not really.
Yeah, but even the Matheson stuff wasn't too in-depth, sort of like with the poor translator from Born Again. Was it Born Again?
Was it? I can't remember.
I refer the handwriting expert from Born Again.
Yeah, well, I suppose Matheson does get a little bit more to do, doesn't he? But
he does, but I never find him particularly not appealing, but maybe just interesting. You know, I'm never really sold on him. Maybe that's why they don't use that resource more, because it doesn't work as well as some of the other ones do.
Yeah, or maybe they were just a bit wary of, like, pushing things too much into, like, the party political arena, which I guess is what would have happened if you start to involve congressmen and senators and whatever. So I wonder. But yeah, no, it's interesting to see which aspects Carter kind of drops in, you know, with a line or two. Because I think that's one of the good things about the pilot, is he kind of he sets up a lot of stuff quite economically. You know, like the way they sketch in Mulder's backstory is done really deftly, isn't it? It's done like in a few paragraphs, basically. And then you get people like Morgan Wong come and sort of take the ball and run with it in other episodes. Yeah, there's definitely more they could have done.
I concur. You know what? I picked up some quotes of David talking about the first season from the official first season episode guide. And I thought it'd be interesting to read some of them. Like, how many people know he wore a tie with pink pigs on it to audition?
I didn't know that, so that's...
So that's one. So now you've learned two things, Reggie, and pink pigs.
Yeah, and the Mulder's ties are quite notorious, aren't they?
They are. So David read the pilot, and he thought it was a really good story, but that UFOs would get boring after three or four episodes. And he thought he would go to Vancouver for a month and get paid, and then go off to do another movie.
Little did he know that 25 years later, he'd still be... he'd still... You know, down that office.
Now, you've probably heard how he's discussed how he and Jillian's voices were higher, and then as they relaxed, the voices got lower too. And since David is as sharp with a turn of phrase as Mulder, he also says, and he went through puberty after season one.
But it's quite fun though, isn't it? Because it makes sense that, you know, they're just, you know, Mulder's been on the X-Files, but his real adventures are when Scully turns up, aren't they? And, you know, whether his voice lowers or whatever, it makes sense that the character would kind of toughen up or whatever, doesn't it? So it doesn't detract at all from it.
No. I think it's just more of a technical thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was going to hit you with a few quotes before we wrap up, but do we have any more messages from social media?
Well, we had some favorite Mulder moments come in. Do you want to hear those?
Yeah.
And we had a couple of least favorite moments too, which we can go through. So Andrew Cook said he loves the way Mulder dejectedly throws the car keys at Scully in The Jersey Devil. Carter incorporating something introduced in Squeeze. Other favourite moments. Caleb Burnett said his favourite moment is from Deep Throat, and it's the moment where Mulder comes back to Deep Throat and says, because the evidence to the contrary is not entirely dissuasive. And I think that whole scene's really good. It's on the running track, isn't it, at the end of Deep Throat? And,
yep.
Very compelling stuff, in my opinion.
Definitely.
Jenny84, her favourite moment is Mulder in Squeeze saying to Scully, do you think I'm spooky? And she says she just giggles every time. Jeff Lavery's favourite thing, he says, those glasses in the pilot were pretty amazing. Yeah, I mean, the glasses go away, don't they? I mean, season 11 Mulder to be, you know, becomes a glasses wearer again. But they were there on day one when he met Scully. And finally, Tina Nimitz says, too many to count, funny and sad, but Do You Think I'm Spooky from Squeeze is one of the funniest. All right, so have you got any least favorite Mulder moments, Paige?
I do. My least favorite Mulder moment is him saying that he made his parents call him Mulder. I have never understood that. His parents are named Mulder.
Well, do you think he's being serious, though, or is he just kind of trying to
I thought he was being serious. You think he was being a wise guy?
I think, just for the same reason that you said, because you can't really imagine how that would work in practice, can you?
Okay.
And then when we do meet, like, Mrs. Mulder, she does call him Fox, doesn't she? So,
she does call him Fox.
Okay, well, a couple of people mentioned moments they didn't like, and Marlene said that, from the pilot, the airplane scene always strikes her as too unprofessional for Mulder. And we've already talked about that one, and yes, I agree, I think. It seems odd, anyway. It seems odd. And Cortland said, the most annoying thing about season one Mulder, the weird way he says little lemon twist in the pilot. Seriously.
I love the way he says little lemon twist, although it does back up your zany theory from earlier where he's written entirely differently than he will be going forward.
And also, where does he get that paint can from that he writes the X on the road with? Because they presumably have hired that car, you know. So why is there just this red paint in the trunk?
He brought it with him in his preparation kit.
Could you take that on the airplane? I guess maybe you could in the 90s.
You can if you have an FBI badge.
There we go then. So I can't really think what my least favorite moment would be. Let me just have a think.
Well, you weren't too happy with that plane business either.
Yeah, but I don't like strongly dislike it or anything. And like I say, I've got the weird view of quite liking Mulder's portrayal in space. And I think for a lot of people, they just hate everything to do with that episode.
I'm a space geek, so I love space. I mean, I know it's not the best X-Files ever, and it won't ever be in my top episodes. But it's an episode I can watch because I'm a space geek.
Well, I think it's like a lot of Chris Carter episodes. There are like just fascinating ideas kind of just flying around there, you know. I tell you what, my least favourite, it's got to be something from Fire, because I actually really don't like Fire, I have to say. And it's weird, because I used to love Fire when I was a kid.
Really?
I did. And just in recent years, whenever I've seen it, it just really rubs me the wrong way. And I don't like Phoebe. I don't like some of the British characters, so I think maybe that's why.
But Mark Sheppard is awesome.
He is good. No, I wouldn't dispute that. No, he is good. He's the saving grace, I think.
He is. I agree.
So anything Mulder does in Fire is my least favorite moment of season one.
Okay. Well, before we get into quotes, I have one quote that I really love that I wanted to bring up. And it's a line that kind of gets overlooked. A lie is most convincingly hidden between two truths.
Mm.
I think that's a seminal line for me in season one. But it's not because it's not catchy, trust no one, I want to believe. You know, it doesn't really get the gravity that I think it really has.
Yeah, and also I think all the stuff between Mulder and Deep Throat there is good, isn't it?
It is. Because later Mulder says he's wondering which lie to believe. This is all great stuff.
Yeah, and also, doesn't he say to him... Now, I might be misremembering this. Doesn't he... It might be the beginning of Erlenmeyer Flask when he says, like, he's tired of all the Obi-Wan Kenobi crap.
Yes.
Yeah, I think just as the season was coming to its end, you know, with EBE and then the Erlenmeyer Flask, that Mulder Deep Throat relationship suddenly gets, like, really compelling, you know. Because I think some of Deep Throat's earlier appearances were a bit kind of one note, you know, like when he turns up in stuff like, I don't know.
I was going to mention that.
Ghost in the Machine or whatever.
Ghost in the Machine, and he's in Eve and like places where, and this starts not to happen in the other seasons. You know, he's in the informant character is more in the conspiracy episodes than not. Occasionally it'll be elsewhere, but in general, they get the pattern down for that.
Yeah, I always forget how little Deep Throat we see, actually. I always, in my memory, he's a much bigger part of season one than he is in reality whenever I go back and watch it. I think that must be a testament to Jerry Hardin, I guess. He kind of makes a good impression in the role, doesn't he?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll do a few quick quotes and a bonus question, and then we'll wrap up.
Okay,
so I willfully participated in a campaign of misinformation. Do you know where that came from?
Is this a multiple choice quiz?
Oh, no. Gosh. yeah.
No, okay. Hang on. I can work this out. I think this is quite early on, isn't it?
Yes.
So let me just run through it. He says, I would never lie. I willfully... Is it Shadows?
It is! Oh my, yeah. That was brilliant. I almost don't want to give you any more. That was so good.
I want to stop while I'm on top. No, let's carry on. Let's
okay.
Go.
Aliens and genetic mutants rarely press charges.
Right then. So this is like at the beginning of an episode. It's when we don't see it, but they've been in court, haven't they? Is that...
Oh. No, but...
Are they walking to their car at this point?
Oh, wow. I don't know if they're walking to their car. Wait a minute. I'm not being tested here.
I need clues, but... Oh, hang on. Okay. I think it's Fire. Is it Fire?
It is Fire. The episode you don't like and you're still nailing it.
It's etched into my memory.
Okay,
yeah.
This one will be easier, I swear.
Okay.
The Addams Family finds religion.
The Addams Family... I mean... I can only assume it's Miracle Man because of the religious aspect.
Oh, no! Oh, no, it's Gender Bender.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah, yes,
but
I see.
I know, but not many of us are sitting around watching Gender Bender all the time. Even the Krychek geeks aren't doing it. Okay, I'll go even easier then.
Okay, go for it.
That's a lot of flannel to be choking down, even for Bigfoot.
Sarah, that must be Darkness Falls.
It is. And now this is...
Excellent.
And no government agency has jurisdiction over the truth.
I think he says this when he's on crutches, if I'm right. It's like a hearing or something in Fallen Angel. Is that the right episode?
It is!
Hey.
Yay! So you only missed one, and it was a really bad episode, so...
Okay, I'm pretty happy with that.
And
that's
now,
respectable, isn't it?
Now your bonus question.
Okay.
In what episode does Mulder finally get to read the field journal?
You mean like he reads the voiceover? Is that what you mean at the end of the...
Yes.
Okay, let me think. I think I remember him reading, but did he do it earlier? I'm going to say Born Again.
Yes! Ding! Nailed it. You totally nailed it.
Fantastic.
Well, Carl, thanks so much for mulling over Mulder with me today. And whereabouts can the X-Files fans find you on the World Wide Web?
Two places mainly. I mean, people can go to Twitter and at csweeney758, and you can find me there. But, I mean, I spend a lot of time, Paige, and I know you spend a bit of time there too, in the X-Files basement on Facebook. So, I mean, I would recommend that to anyone listening, and I'm sure you would too.
Definitely. I was going to say the exact same thing when I'm not writing my series rewatch blog with my sister called Sibling Cinema on Blogger. And we're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, Pinterest. Just look for sibling_cinema or sibling-cinema, and you're bound to come across us.
So how's it going, Paige? How quickly are you? I mean, we're recording this in June, and you're season four?
We are deep in season four. We are specifically up to Unrequited, which I'm excited about because I think it's an underrated episode. But that's a story for another day. So thanks for being on with me, Carl.
Yep, no worries.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And remember, as always, trust no one.
The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/TheXcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/TheXcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A Y E.